Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
We've been studying finding Jesus in the Old Testament. The scripture that I had you read was talking about kings. And so what we're going to look at tonight is how the kings of Israel were a pattern for Jesus being king. And we actually see some comparison and contrast between the kings we read about for the Israelites and then Jesus. So I thought we'd take just a minute to review the books of the Old Testament that covers the kings that we see in the Old Testament. And there's really six books. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles. So 1 Samuel actually starts from the birth of Samuel, and then it ends, it goes to the end of Saul's reign. And then 2 Samuel picks up and describes David's reign from there. And then we move the 1 and 2 Kings, and then you got 1 and 2 Chronicles, and they're from different perspectives. So if you look at 1 and 2 Kings, they actually start, or they begin with David's death, and they trace that history of the United Kingdom, and then when they divide, but they end with this whole note of hope, if you look at the end of 2 Kings, about a king shall come and release Judah from prison. Then if you look at 1 and 2 Chronicles, they're very specific as compared to 1 and 2 Kings. 1 and 2 Chronicles really focus on David, and they talk about David's rise to power, and then they focus specifically on David's descendants and those kings that descended from him. And then they kind of conclude in the end of 2 Chronicles where Cyrus proclaims that the Jews can leave and go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. So just a little bit of history. That's how we go through and we take a look at the kings. But I think it's always good to understand the perspective from 1 and 2 Samuel and then the difference between 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, with 1 and 2 Chronicles really focusing on David and his descendants. So let's talk a minute about David the king, right? So God tells him that he's going to make him a shepherd of his people. So David goes from being a shepherd of sheep to being a shepherd over God's people, or the Israelites. And he gets anointed three times, right? When he was young, Samuel actually went to David's father's house and anointed David as a young man. Then he got anointed by the tribe of Judah. And then ultimately, after Saul's death, when he became king, he was anointed again by all of Israel, right? So there's these three anointings that take place with David. The word anointed or anointed one, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that word in Hebrew, but that Hebrew word is the same root word where we get our word Messiah, okay? I think that's very important for us as we talk about Jesus and we talk about Christ and that Greek meaning of Christ, that we understand this anointed or anointed one is actually the root word. It gives you this idea of the Messiah or the Savior, the one who's going to save. And so we see David anointed three times before he becomes king. So let's start off with, before we get into David, let's go take a look at Psalms. So if we look at Psalms chapter 72 in verses 1 and 2, Psalms describes or talks about a righteous king. And Psalms 1 and 2 says, give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. Most believe, we know that it's probably either written directed to Solomon from David, or Solomon actually wrote this himself. But he says, may he judge over your people with righteousness and your poor with justice, right? So what we see are these qualities of what a king should be, of what a righteous king should be. That righteous king should judge people with righteousness and justice, right? We see that emphasized. If we keep looking, we see that in verse 3 of Psalm 72, let the mountain bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. So it gets this idea that if you have a righteous king, not only will he do those qualities, but also his people will be blessed, right? That they'll be blessed, they'll be prosperous. And then we kind of close with 12 and 14, where it says, for he, talking about this king, delivers the needy when he calls, the poor and him who has no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life and precious is their blood in his sight. So when we read this whole idea that Psalms put out of this righteous king, right? Not only is it David's wish or his desire for Solomon to be that way, but Psalms is also describing the future king that's going to be a descendant of David, which is Jesus, right? It's that kind of that prophecy that we wind up seeing. And once again, I know it's kind of tough, so I'm going to ask this question. You guys can think about it. But what is so important, right? Why do you think these qualities, especially this whole idea of righteousness, righteous judgment, and justice judgment, why do you think those qualities are so important? Why would they be important to you, right? If we had a king as being subservient to that king, why would they be important to us, right? They'll be important to us because that's how he's going to deal with us, and it's going to be a little bit better, right, than if you have a king who oppresses or a king who doesn't. And so Psalms kind of sets this out. If we go to Psalms chapter 2, which we know was written by David, David says, I will tell of the decree the Lord said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So here we see a covenant, or David talks about a promise that God has made to him. And that's what that decree, that word decree means, is that God has made a covenant. He's made a promise to David that through David descendants, there'll be a kingdom that will reign forever and all will be blessed. And if you'll notice that first part, it says, you are my son, today I have begotten you. If we go to Acts chapter 13, verse 33, it says, this he has fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus, as also it is written in the second Psalm, you are my son, today I have begotten you. So we see this parallel that we've talked about so many times between David and the life of David, and then how that gets mirrored with Jesus. So now let's move into your homework reading, which was 2 Samuel chapter 7, right? So if you read that, 2 Samuel chapter 7, you see in verse 2 that David was kind of upset, or there was something that seemed very wrong to David. And what was that that troubled David so much? Well, David realized that he was living in a palace made of cedar, right? Cedar being a very expensive, precious wood, if you will. But David realized that he was living in a palace of cedar, and God still dwelled in a tent. And so for him, what he thought was it wasn't right. It wasn't right for him to be in a house of cedar in a palace and God being in a tent. So in verse 3, right, in verse 3 of 2 Samuel, Nathan tells David, gives David some advice. Nathan tells David, well, do it, right? you go do it. You can take care of that, right? So Nathan kind of speaks before spoken to by God and tells David, hey, go build God a house of cedar. But then in verses 4 and 5, it says, the same night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, and go tell my servant, thus says the Lord, would you build me a house to dwell in? And then as we go through, what we realize is that God's not, if we remember the story, God is not going to allow David to build the temple, but rather it's going to be Solomon, right? So let's keep on going. When we think about that, did the idea that David have of building God a place, was that pleasing to God? Well, we know it was, because what we'll see in verse 11 is God tells David that because of this, that the Lord will make you a house, all right? Now, all of us, I don't know if you remember, like Harry Potter, all these movies where they have these houses, right? And it's very important to have this house. And what God's telling David is that he's going to create for him a house that's going to be well-known. It's going to be thriving. It's going to be this promise that God makes to David that it's going to be through him that's established this dynasty, if you will. But then we'll know a little bit about that we'll wind up seeing. If we look at verse 12, it says, this is God speaking to David, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And if we look at verse 13, and then he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So there's kind of two different people that's being talked about here, right? There's the idea that one of David's sons is going to build that temple. But if you look at the long picture, the big picture, right, that throne of David's is going to have a kingdom that's going to wind up lasting forever. And so we get this promise of God that's made to David that he's going to build David a house, but that's going to be in a form of a dynasty. And why did God, a little bit of Bible quiz here, why did God not want David to build his temple? Because he had blood on his hands, right? He was a great warrior. He was that man, and God said he had that blood on his hands. What would have been... For a lot of people, right, if you want to do something and you're told no, how would a lot of people respond? Right? A lot of us would probably just say, okay, fine, and not do anything. Some of us might try to take matters into our own hands. But remember what David did, right? David began gathering all the materials for Solomon, right? He didn't let the fact that he couldn't be the one who actually built it, it didn't keep him from actually participating in the process or helping his son Solomon in that process, right? And then what we see is kind of in this promise that God made to David, there are some, maybe, I'm not going to call them conditions, right, but God says, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, right? But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me, and your throne shall be established forever. Okay? So these are the things that God is telling David. Now, what did the Jews have a problem with, or how did the Jews interpret this throughout their history and even into the New Testament? They thought this to be an earthly dynasty, right? They considered it to be a kingdom or some dynasty that would last on earth forever. And we know now from reading the scriptures and seeing how it plays out, that it's not an earthly dynasty, right? But rather it's a spiritual, or it's the church. It's this dynasty that lasts forever because of the sacrifice of Christ. So let's talk a little bit about Solomon. So we all know that God instructed David to select Solomon as an heir, and Solomon would build a temple. So one of the things about this lesson that was difficult for me is I kept going. I had lunch with a friend of mine, and he's teaching where he goes in Plainview. He's teaching teenagers, and we started talking about rabbit holes. Because one of the problems I've had with this lesson is I've kept going down rabbit holes. So one of the rabbit holes here is this whole idea of Solomon being David's heir. Was Solomon the heir, as typically would happen with the kings and their sons? Who was David's first son? Well, his first son was Absalom, right? So we know by this time, by the time David's on his deathbed, Absalom is gone. And so really what we see in 1 Kings 1:5 is that the next in line, Adonijah, he, before David was even dead, he was saying, I'm going to be king. And he was throwing himself a party, and he had chariots, he had horsemen, and he was getting ready. I mean, David is on his deathbed. God's instructed David to select Solomon, but the one who feels like he's in the next line to be king, he has already got himself ready, right? And I think the rabbit hole I went down is verse 6, where it says his father, that father being David, his father, talking about Adonijah, had never at any time displeased him by asking, what have you done thus and so? So I began to think about myself as a parent. And I thought, have I ever at any time displeased any of either of my kids? And if you ask them, the answer is probably going to be yes, right? But I thought about, of all the great things that David had done, where we see David's weakness is his parenting skills. Can you imagine raising a child and not one time saying anything that would upset that child or make that child angry or make that child mad, right? So here we've got this child, I'm going to be king, and he's never been, you know, he's never been disciplined, anything like that. And I really think about, as we look at David's life, there's so many great examples for us, but we also see an example of how we can get so committed to a certain work that we often neglect our families, right? And so it's very difficult for us as we go to keep that balance between that we have. And so here we have Adonijah getting ready to throw the big party. Then when we move to verse 11 through 14, so then Nathan went to Bathsheba and said, have you not heard of what's going on? Let me give you some advice, right? Because if Adonijah becomes king, what typically happens to all the other siblings, right? Typically, whoever gets king kind of eliminates all the other siblings. So Nathan goes to Bathsheba and say, let me give you some advice to save your life and your son's life. You go to King David, right? And you remind him of what's going on. You remind him that God said, God has chosen Solomon to be king and to reign after him. And then you say, well, why is your other son down there setting up the king coronation party, right? And then while you're talking, Nathan's going to come in and confirm your words, right? So they go to David on his deathbed. And so as David is in his bed dying, he brings his general in and makes sure, and they anoint, they take care, make sure Solomon becomes king. Then if you want to, great reading, keep reading, and then you see the interaction between Solomon an adigena of whether or not adigena is going to accept it or whether he's worried about getting killed. But great, one of the great stories, but then also one of the sad stories about, you know, someone we look up to so much in David, but not doing a great job in his own house, right? That we read. All right, so let's go back to Solomon. So David gives Solomon some advice. He says, "And you, Solomon, my son, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every plan and thought. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever." So let's think about this whole idea of what God, or what does God search and understand, right? And how do we serve with a whole heart and a willing mind? What does it mean to serve with a whole heart and a willing mind? I think we've got to understand that that whole idea of a whole heart means we can't like have a toe in the water and not, right? We got to be fully committed. So I don't think he's in here, but Brian Wisdom and I are friends, and we actually bought fishing kayaks. And there's nothing more fun than watching two large men in their late 50s try to get in and out of kayaks, right? And so when we did our maiden voyage a couple weeks ago, I put on, because I typically wade fish, so I put on wading boots, and I said, you know what? I'm going to make the commitment that my feet are going to get wet, but that's the only thing that's going to get wet. So I stepped in there, right? So this whole idea of the whole heart means you got to be all in, right? You can't just be in part of the time. You can't be in the other part of the time. How many of y'all have gone to some place on vacation where we used to do it when we would take the kids to the Smokies, right? And you get up there and you could put one foot in Tennessee and you could put one foot in North Carolina, right? What David's telling Solomon is you got to be all in. There's no, you know, part-time. You've got to be all in with a whole heart and a willing mind. And what he tells them is that God will know, right? You can't fool God. On the outside, you may be acting like you're all in, but God searches the heart, right? God knows exactly whether you're all in or not all in. And I think if we go to 1 John 4:19, we read, "We love because he first loved us," right? And so the question is, why do we serve him? Well, we serve him out of that love that he's shown to us and our gratitude for that, right? And so, you know, all of us go through situations. All of us have times in our life where that situation weighs very much on us, right? And it's sitting on our shoulders and our knees are about to buckle, right? I think it's during those times, during those struggles, where we ask ourselves, how can I serve with a whole heart? How can I be fully committed? And how can I be willing in this type of situation? And I think we know, or when we do that, we understand that by faith we'll be taken care of. I want you to look while we're in, I don't have it on the slide, but if we look at in 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 20, David tells the Solomon, he says, "All this he," meaning God, "made clear to me in writing from the hand of the Lord, all the work according to the plan." So David was given instructions by God about the temple, very specific instructions, and David left a detailed plan for Solomon to follow. And he says in verse 20, "Then David said to Solomon, 'Son, be strong and courageous and do it. Do not be afraid, do not be dismayed, for the Lord God, even my God, is with you. He will not leave you or forsake you until all the work for the service of the house of the Lord is finished.'" Okay? So not only do we have this king, we have him creating this magnificent temple. And that's going to fall in when we hit some verses in the New Testament as well. That's kind of why we're kind of covering it. All right, so let's talk a little quicker, pick up a couple speed, right? So Solomon started with a whole heart. He started with a heart after God, but we know that didn't last too long, right? We know with all the concubines, all the wives, everything, we know that Solomon at some point didn't have that whole heart following. If we think about it, after Solomon, the kingdom got split in two, right? You had the southern kingdom of Judah in 1 Kings 14:26. Egypt attacked Judah and took all the temple treasures and took them back to Egypt. All the things that David had gathered for the temple, all the things that Solomon had craftsmen build for the temple, all of that, the Egyptians took it when they came in and took it back to Egypt. And then you had the northern kingdom, right? You had Jeroboam, who was the king. Everybody was supposed to go to the temple to worship. The temple was in Jerusalem, which was in the southern kingdom. Jeroboam was afraid that everybody was going to leave the northern kingdom and stay in Jerusalem. So he set up two golden calves for them to worship in the northern kingdom. And it bothered so many of the Israelites and the tribe of Levi, many of them did leave and go to the southern kingdom. But you saw this split. And then 300 years after David, Isaiah prophesied that God was going to send Israel into exile. So then we have the whole story in 1 and 2 Chronicles and 1 and 2 Kings, how there was just this up and down, right? You'd have a good king and a bad king, a good king and a bad king, until finally they were all carried off into captivity. All right. So this afternoon, something hit me about these verses, and so I quickly jotted everything down, but I have notes going sideways and upside down, so we'll have to go through this a little slow, right? But I want us to spend some time with Isaiah chapter 5, if you want to go ahead and turn there. So in Isaiah chapter 5, beginning with verse 1, Isaiah actually gives a parable, and we're studying parables on Sunday in our Connect Groups class, so I thought it would be pretty good. So let's start with Isaiah chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. So this starts the parable, right? There's this owner who has a vineyard in a very fertile area. And then in verse 2 it says, he dug it, he cleared it of stones, and planted it with the choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it. He hewed out a vine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. So he tells this parable about there was an owner of a vineyard who took his area, he cultivated it, he removed all the stones, he got everything right, he planted the best grapes, the best vines for those grapes. He set a watchtower, he put a hedge around it, he built a vat for making that wine, but then when he went to go harvest it, all he had was wild grapes. So now what's the difference between the good grapes he planted and wild grapes? So wild grapes are sour. Wild grapes are not good for making wine. The grapes he planted were those good grapes. And so what Isaiah does is he tells this parable, and then he starts in verse 5 through 7, where he says the parable, it actually means that the vineyard of the Lord, right, the vineyard owner is God, the vineyard is Israel. And God did everything he could do, right? Think about the history. God did everything he could do for the Israelites. And at the end of it, instead of looking for justice, instead of looking for righteousness, which if we go all the way back to where we started, those are the qualities of a good king, right? He got bloodshed. He got this outcry. And so God poses this question of, is there anything I could have done different? is there anything else I could have done to get this different outcome, right? And how many of us asks ourselves that question? Is there anything I could have done for this particular thing not to have happened? Is there anything that I could change? If there's anything I could go back and change, is there anything that I can do where the outcome would have been different? And as I read that, I think there were two things that struck me. Is that when we have those things in our lives, when we go through those difficult patches, the parable is quite clear. The owner of the vineyard did not plant wild grapes. He didn't plant sour grapes. And so we look at that parable, when those things happen, when we go through those things, I think it's important for us to remember those don't come from God. God doesn't plant sour grapes in us. He doesn't have us be those wild and sour grapes. When we feel anxious, if we feel depressed, those things aren't from God. God planted us as the best grapes, right? He planted us to be loved. He planted us to be nurturing. He planted us as those good grapes. And Siegfried reminded me, maybe after the first class, where we talked about the angels, right? That God made us higher than the angels, right? And so God doesn't want us carrying around that weight that comes with those wild grapes. He doesn't want us to carry around that weight of sin. And that brings me to the second point, is he loved us so much that he sent his son, right? Galatians chapter 5 tells us that Jesus sets us free, right? And I just look at that parable and I think, you know what? We can do everything. We think we can do everything right. We think we can put this hedge around that nothing's going to happen, but sometimes things happen. And those things don't come from God. They're not because of anything in our character, because God created us as good grapes, right? We have value to the Lord. He values us higher than the angels, right? And we got to try not to let that weight us down. We got to remember what it says in Galatians about Jesus setting us free. And I think when we look at that parable and we see how well it relates to the Israelites, what happened, right? So what the vineyard owner did was take down the protective hedge and just start over. What happened to Israel once God took down that protective hedge? That's when they were carried off into captivity. And so before we move in the New Testament, let's look at a couple more examples of this whole idea of the vineyard. If we go to Hosea chapter 10, Hosea tells this story again, where that Israel is like a luxurious grapevine, right, that yields fruit. But it says, the more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. Has his country improved? He improved his pillars. Their heart is false, and now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. For now they will say, we have no king, for we do not fear the Lord. And a king, what could he do for us? They utter mere words with empty oaths, and they make these covenants. I think it's quite interesting, right? As we read this, that the Israelites begin to prosper. But in their prosperity, instead of giving God the glory, they start building altars, the idols, right? And then they're carried off into captivity. And then you notice what they say. They say, we have no king, for we do not fear the Lord. But then they add to that, but a king, what could a king do for us? They utter mere words with empty oaths and they make covenants, right? Politicians. But think about the history. Did God start by giving them a king? No. What God wanted them to realize, he was their king. They weren't going to have an earthly king. But the people demanded and demanded and demanded a king, and he gave in and gave them Saul. And now what they look at is that earthly king doesn't do anything for us. It's no good. So they had the great king. They had the righteous king. They had the king that judged with justice. They wanted an earthly king. And now they're to a point where an earthly king, they just say the words and they don't carry through, right? And so you see how this story has gone from the beginning to what they had to kind of where they're at now. All right. So let's look at this whole idea of this future king. So Ezekiel tells us, "And I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David shall be a prince among them. I am the Lord, I have spoken." So my question is, God made a promise to David about his descendant being reign. We see him carried off into captivity. So does that mean that God broke that promise or no longer kept that promise? No. If you remember that promise, God said, as long as they follow me, or, you know, if they have the iniquity, I'm going to discipline them, but I'll always love them, right? If we go back. Because of time, I can't read it, but 1 Chronicles 28, verses 19 to 20, God tells the kings that they're not the shepherds. In fact, they are feeding on the sheep. They're taking advantage of the people. They're not that king that rules with righteousness or treats people justly, right? And he condemns them for being shepherds who actually make the sheep the prey instead of taking care of them. If we look at Zechariah 9:9, it says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of the donkey." So we have this whole prophecy now about this king who's coming. He's going to be righteous, he's going to be justice, he's going to be humble, and he's going to come in mounted on a donkey or a colt, the foal of a donkey, right? So we get this prophecy in Zechariah. And now let's go to the New Testament. Gabriel, right, goes to Mary and tells Mary, "Behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom there will be no end." So we have Gabriel making this promise to Mary, or telling Mary this, and once again, we get this idea that this kingdom is not going to, there'll be no end to that kingdom, right? But once again, it's not about an earthly dynasty. That this king who's going to come is going to be the forever king, the one who lasts forever. So let's keep going. So the king revealed. We're all familiar with this verse. Peter, Jesus asked his apostles, "Who do people say I am?" And Peter says, he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." Now, let's talk about that word Christ for a minute. We talked about that word anointed one in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, that referred to as the Messiah. In Greek, Christ, the root word for that in Greek is Messiah, or I'm sorry, is anointed one, right? And so Peter is saying, "You are the anointed one." You are the one who is king. You're that anointed one. But it wasn't just the apostles, right? If you remember blind Bartimaeus in Mark chapter 10, when Bartimaeus heard it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me," right? So we start seeing that this king is revealed as Jesus through what people are calling him, both his apostles as well as people as well. And then we kind of have this this great story that you guys are all familiar with, where as they're going in to Jerusalem, Jesus goes to a fig tree because he's hungry, and that tree is bearing no fruit. And so Jesus curses that fig tree. And then in chapter 12, he gives that parable, almost a little bit identical to what Isaiah gave, where there was a man who planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, prepared everything, built a tower, and then went into the country. And then, you know, when he sent his servants to gather that fruit, they murdered. But we get that parable of where the king is looking for that fruit. Then we go into John 18, where Jesus before Pilate. And Pilate says, "Are you king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "My kingdom's not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Right? So Jesus makes this statement about his kingdom, his kingship, that we read from David, right? And we all know the story where Jesus, where Pilate on the crucifixion wrote that Jesus of Nazareth, the king of the Jews, and the Jews, Pharisees wanted him to take it down, and he wouldn't do it, right? That's painful to read. So we won't read that. But if you get a chance, read Hebrews chapter 12, and this is verses 3 through 11. The author of Hebrews calls Jesus, Jesus Christ, uses that phrase multiple times. Meaning that, remember, Hebrews is written, a lot of it is written to the Jews, but he uses that term, Jesus Christ, so that those readers who were Jews would understand that Jesus was the anointed one, that he was referring back to David as being the anointed one and Jesus being from the house of David. And so when we think about this in Hebrews, right, when we struggle, when we have difficult times, we have a king. We have a king who is what is defined in Psalm 72 as being righteous and treating the poor with justice. And so when we struggle, we consider him who endured that hostility, and we won't grow weary or faint-hearted. Why should we, in chapter 12, that reading, why do we endure hardships? Is the for discipline that you've endured, God's treating you as sons. What does that discipline yield? That discipline yields fruit. And so the Old Testament paints this picture is if you have a good king, if you have a righteous king, if you have a righteous king who deals with justice, that everyone in the kingdom will prosper and they'll all bear fruit. So now what we see as people within a kingdom, right, that it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness by those who've been trained by it. We see that example from the king. So just a couple final thoughts for the bell works. If we go to Ephesians chapter 1, verses 20 through 21, what we see is this whole idea that the church, Jesus is the head of the church, we're his body, but what I want to get to is this whole idea of the holy temple. And this is one of those rabbit holes I went down, is this whole idea of the temple. And so what we read, right, is Matthew 12, 6 says, "I tell you, something greater than the temple is here." Okay? Remember what the Jews thought of the temple. Something's greater. Haggai 2:9 says, "The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts. And in this place I will give peace, declares the Lord." So in Haggai says, we got a temple now and it's pretty glorious. But the next temple or the latter is going to be even more so. Right? And so what we see is that Jesus identified himself as the temple because he assumed the role of that sacrificial system that Mark talked about last quarter, but he's greater than the temple because God is in him in a way that God could never be in just a physical structure. And also because that spirit dwells within us as well. And so we are part of that temple. As we go through the church. So Well, homework for next week. I can't go back. Homework for next week is, y'all have to write it down, I'm sorry. So the homework for next week, I was waiting to see if we could slide up, is read. All right, so next week we're going to talk about Jesus the priest. So read Genesis chapter 14, verses 17 through 24, and then Psalms 110. So that'll be the reading for next week. Genesis 14, 17 through 24, and then Psalms chapter 10.